Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. We're doing a long form interview today with a OG veteran, an OG reporter, one of the best in the biz. He's a professor as well. Sean Patrick Griffin, the godfather of Philadelphia Black Mafia history and reporting. He wrote the book Black Brothers, Inc., which is one of the best true crime books ever written. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be back again, Scott.
So we had him on about a year ago, maybe less than a year, and we talked more kind of in generalities. But this week, we're in the middle of September now. It's the 50-year anniversary of the landmark Philadelphia Black Mafia bust, the first bust of the organization. And it was kind of the first domino to fall in the eventual dismantling of that group, which then we all, the people that have followed the stuff knows that it kind of rejuvenated in the 80s with the JBM, the Junior Black Mafia. But the original guys, I guess you could kind of say the beginning of the end started in September of 1974. About 12 guys got indicted, and at the top of the indictment was Eugene Bo Baines, who was the boss at that time of the PBM. So just give us your take 50 years removed from it.
Well, for those of you who are not familiar with the story, Philly's Black Mafia had been reigning for at least 10 years, 15 years by that point. And as Scott pointed out, this was a big deal because up until roughly late 1972, early 73, law enforcement didn't even acknowledge the group. They had intelligence on individual people or clusters of people being arrested in a robbery or in a bank robbery or in a murder, but they weren't piecing it all together as, oh my goodness, these people are running entire sections of the city. They're running heroin along the Eastern Seaboard. So when you get to 1974, you correctly point out that Eugene Bo Baines was the main person being indicted in that indictment. It's a little misleading for people who don't know the story. Everyone who watches TV has heard the name Sam Christian and Ron Harvey. They were the two heavies, but they were also founding members, and they were on the most wanted list for a series of murders. And so Bo Baines' rise to prominence in the summer of 1973. But it's short-lived, as you just pointed out, which is by the time the feds catch on to this and they put, the strike force gets onto it and they put all the resources into it, they get to a major drug racketeering indictment, which was noteworthy because the DEA was new. It was a big deal. The idea that they're going to have this massive conspiracy case. The DEA head in D.C. actually commented on the case. It was that big a deal nationally. And so when Bo Baines and Gene Hearn and all the heavy, other than
James Fox, Russell Barnes.
Yeah, I mean, it was the entire leadership from that night, the 1960s iteration of the Black Mafia. They were all picked off over a period of about a week, roughly 50 years ago this week.
And I always like to find the confluence of, pop culture and crime. I'm a big music buff. I think we talked about this the last time you were here, but, drilling down into who Bo Baines is, and Bo ended up doing almost 20 years, came out, I think, in 90-ish, died in 2012. But, before he got locked up, he was the road manager of the Delphonics, which is like, a pretty significant part of 1970s soul music. It was kind of the defining Philly soul sound.
For people our age and older, if they don't remember, they can go on YouTube. I actually show this in my class every once in a while. Yep. The Delphonics had a hit called La La Means I Love You.
Yep.
Everybody has heard that song. And so to have Bo Baines working on behalf of Philly Groove Records, which owned the Delphonics at that point in time. And of course, when that hit, the Delphonics didn't want to be a local act any longer. They wanted to expand their horizons. Well, they were leaned on by Bo Baines saying, no, I don't think you understand.
They wanted to get a new booking agent, and they wanted to do their own collecting of dues. Right. Exactly. And Bo Baines had a meeting with them and said, no, that's not happening. We're staying with the
and by the way, speaking of the music scene, before then, what Bo Baines would do on behalf of Philly Groove Records, he would go to local disc jockeys and intimidate them to play their records. That was old school, you know, gangster.
Philly,
you know.
Philly Groove Records, from just my recent research, founded in 1967, a Philly Black Mafia affiliate. Would you call him a member, John Watson, Stan the Man Watson?
No, I would just say an affiliate. I mean, he was clearly immersed in that world, but he wasn't one of the guys who was really doing this stuff.
And Watson hired Bo. I've talked to, you know, we're here in Detroit, here at OG Pod Ground Zero. And first I'll say that Sam Christian was actually hiding out in Detroit from those murder indictments, and was actually caught here and was held here for a while. And I talked to some of the guys that I know that were involved in kind of the darker aspects of Motown. And they all remember Bo. You know, in their mind, and I think it's probably true, Philly Groove, that sound that was coming out of Philly was in some ways kind of a response, you know, I guess within the industry, to Motown, which was coming out of Detroit. Right. And so the Motown guys were definitely aware of what was going on in Philadelphia, both in the music business, obviously, and there was some crossover with the Nation of Islam and all that stuff. But
there's another aspect to this, which is Philly's Black Mafia, like many gangsters, took advantage of the music industry, meaning when people would tour, that's a great way to launder drug money. It's a great way to launder all sorts of money. You know, they would collapse it with the gate, and, you know, there's no way to distinguish what percentage is tickets, what percentage is, you know, sales versus the money that they're laundering through the gate. Smart business.
And then they around the same time, just piggybacking off what you said, within the more urban music scene, that space started to, again, kind of be inspired by stuff that had happened before. And then you had a lot of these music festivals with rock and roll and folk music that were coming up in the late 60s. But by the 70s, you started to have more R&B like festivals around the country. And I know there were a lot of different, exactly what you just said, these events with major acts that were over a 2 or 3 day period. And it was just, you know, like the open season for commingling dirty money and skimming. And
well, and the thing is, I don't know what it was like in Detroit, but in Philly, especially in Black Philly, for people who are not familiar with Philadelphia, like many big cities, it's got, you know, big sections of the city. One of them is West Philadelphia. And there was a famous strip called the 52nd Street Strip, where at that point in time, it was a weird mixture of high life, of commerce, and you would see Black gangsters, white gangsters, politicians, celebrities. Well, Philly's Black Mafia ran 52nd Street, including Bo Baines, since we're talking about Bo Baines. Well, what would happen when the music artists would come into town, they would hang out with all these guys. And if they needed heroin, which was the drug of choice at the time, or coke or whatever, they had stash houses. So you could take your woman, you would have an entire apparatus set up for you, and they would. That's what I'm saying. Like, each party got what they needed out of this arrangement.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is about the Philly Black Mafia. The last thing I'll say here in Detroit about Motown was that there were drug kingpins in Detroit who, like, huge chunks of their business were just what you just said. Like, not only were they helping and providing, you know, resources for narcotics consumption and purchase when celebrities were coming into town. In some ways, Eddie, and I'm just going to throw out a name for Detroit, is Eddie Jackson. He was kind of like part and parcel of Motown. Like, he was like the drug supply wing of Motown. Like, all of the acts that were into heavier drugs had like in-house supply.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's, I didn't write about it in Black Brothers and I've never named him, but there was a prominent DJ that anybody in Philadelphia for 50 years would have known who was taken out of one of these, you know, I don't know what you would call them, you know, crash pads for the, for the celebrities where all the stuff was being done and whatever. And they had to take him out one night, but like, that was just that world at that time. You know, they didn't think anything of it. And I always question, I don't quite know if the artists really knew what bad dudes they were hanging out with. I know it was fun and flashy and they were getting what they needed, but these people were ruthless. And anyway, so yeah, that was a, it was a fascinating time.
It's like they don't, they didn't want to know. They didn't ask questions.
Could be, yeah.
Guy has good dope. He dresses nice. He has a nice car. Yeah. And then just to go back to the Philadelphia aspect of this, and then we'll go more into the people in the bus itself. But Teddy Pendergrass, he wasn't Philly Groove Records, but he was a legend in the R&B industry at that time. One of the top selling acts. Most well-known acts, very handsome, debonair, was known as a ladies' man. And, you know, Bo Baines was very close with Teddy, and he was running around with a lot of those guys. And I know there was his manager ended up getting killed.
Yes, although I have to say, I'm familiar with all the things you're talking about, and I've been interviewed about this before. I can only say that during a decade of interviews, and I have every document you can imagine from every federal agency, everything Philly, there's never even a mention of Teddy Pendergrass. That doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Right.
I'm simply saying that I can talk extemporaneously about Muhammad Ali, about any number of people.
Yeah.
But I have nothing to offer with Teddy Pendergrass. That's by the way, those revelations are really very new, like in the last 10 years. I knew nothing about it. When I heard about them, I followed up with my sources and they knew nothing. So doesn't mean it didn't happen, but, you know,
well, let's go on to what something you just said, and then we'll get into maybe the granulars of the people in the bus. But for people that maybe didn't catch the last interview or aren't, you know, super well-versed in Philly Black Mafia, can you give them like maybe 3 to 5 minutes on Muhammad Ali? And how his, how him as a sports personality and civil rights activist, how his life really tailed with the Philadelphia Black Mafia.
Sure. Well, the short version of the story is Philly's Black Mafia forms sometime in the late 50s, early 60s, who the heck knows. But by the mid to late 60s, they're being arrested in clusters, and they're mainly an extortion-based syndicate, meaning they're not dealing drugs, they're extorting drug dealers. They're extorting bar owners who are allowing drug dealing to go on in the establishment. They're extorting people who are allowing prostitution to take place or gambling to take place in their hotel or in their restaurant or any of those places. So they were an extortion-based syndicate. Now, here's the thing. You know this, and I'm sure your listeners know. If you're going to be what we in academia call power syndicate, which is based on extortion, you can only do that if you commit public acts of violence. You can only go up to fellow criminals so many times and say, you're going to pay me X number per week. They start calling themselves Philadelphia's Black Mafia. The earliest reference in law enforcement files to Philly's Black Mafia is 1968. That's why I always say, and by the way, when I say referenced, whoever that person was, there was an informant who listed all the people that we would later come to know 10 years from then, all the people who are running everything. But anyway, so they were an extortion-based syndicate, mostly in Black sections of the city, and mostly at the start, only with illicit entrepreneurs. It was only after they gained a lot of clout and a lot of public acts of violence where they started shaking down legitimate businesses. And the key about that is, people, when they talk about Philly's Black Mafia, focus on the murders. I get that. They're sensational. I mean, they murdered dozens of people, mostly high-profile murders in public on purpose, though, because they wanted people to know who they were. But if you look at their history and at their rap sheets, they don't do time for the murders for the most part. It's very rare that it's the murders that catches them. The 1974 case that we're going to talk about in a little bit, that actually is the evidence of their mistake. The reason that they had this incredible run, if you're able to get 5 or 10 years doing what they were doing and making that kind of money for that long in the underworld, you're doing a great job. They made the colossal error many people do, which is instead of just taking a percentage of the trade, they said, well, why don't we just take over the trade? Well, the problem is, of course, it doesn't matter what a badass you are if you're on a drug wiretap or if you've got the drugs on you. You can't terrorize witnesses. They don't need witnesses. The federal government doesn't need witnesses. So that's how they got their start. They expand into legitimate businesses. People, of course, know the infamous January 4th, 1971, DeBrow's furniture store case where they went in. Wasn't really a robbery. It was January 4th. It was a dumb time to do a robbery, of course. It's after the Christmas season and they don't have much in the till. And that wasn't the point. The point was that they weren't paying the street tax. And so they tied up all the employees, set the building on fire, and set the employees on fire. That sort of stuff is what they would do. And they obviously, you gain notoriety when you do that. But if you look at the headlines back then, there's no mention of anything called Philadelphia's Black Mafia.
Right.
And so anyway, that goes on. The other famous case people like to talk about is the April 1972 Club Harlem murder in Atlantic City, New Jersey, where in front of 400 to 600 people at a nightclub. If people have ever seen the movie Scarface, the scene where Al Pacino is all coked up and slunken down at the corner booth in the lounge. That's exactly what happened in the Club Harlem, where Fat Ty Palmer, a major heroin dealer who was a go-between between New York City and Philly. Long story, but he owed the Black Mafia guys money. He couldn't pay a debt. They visit him in public on purpose. They march across the dance floor with their guns drawn. It's not a surprise. And they kill him, his bodyguard, and him and people who were with him in the thing. So anyway, that again, this is a major news story. You can't do this in public without it's news. But there's no reference in the dozens of news articles to anything called Philly's Black Mafia because nobody knew. It was that case, by the way, where Atlantic City police called Philly PD and said, hey, we need intelligence on Philadelphia's Black Mafia. And of course, the organized crime unit guy said, what's Philadelphia's Black Mafia? They had no idea what they were talking about. So anyway, so you get to 73. By then, Philly's Black Mafia is cruising. They're running heroin throughout all, I think the DEA said it was 60% of the city's heroin traffic was controlled by Philly's Black Mafia. They're extorting numbers runners, white and black, all throughout sections of the city. Major people. Now, getting to your last point about civil rights and Muhammad Ali, by the time you get to 1973, Philly's Black Mafia at that point was totally immersed in the Nation of Islam. The leadership of Philly's Black Mafia were almost all members of the Fruit of Islam, which was the paramilitary faction of the Nation of Islam. So it's not only that they were part of a Black power group that was racial separatist, the leaders were members of the Fruit of Islam. And for those of you who don't know, that was they were the protectors of the mosque.
They were the muscle.
Yeah, exactly. And the stories are legendary. I included a few of them in Black Brothers, but one of them is where you would talk to people back then. They would say that if you could have a brand new Cadillac, park it in the worst neighborhood of the city, roll the windows down and leave the keys on the dashboard. And as long as it had Muhammad Speaks, the Nation of Islam newspaper on it, no one would touch it. You just didn't mess with the nation. And so for the public, though, it was very confusing because on the one hand, you see them all in their, you know, snazzy tuxes and they look like they're upstanding people who are looking to get better and better the Black community. And here they are. They're actually hustlers and murderers. And they're using the mosque to hide weapons because back then you couldn't get a search warrant for house of worship. So they were informant reports were crazy, whether it was in Philly and other cities, too, where the mosques were being used not only to hide people, but to hide things. You mentioned earlier that Sam Christian was caught in 1973 hiding in Detroit. Another guy, Nudie Mims, was caught in Chicago. And they weren't, by the way, they weren't caught in Detroit and Chicago. They were caught through the mosques. They were tracking. Yeah,
they were being hidden by the nation.
Exactly. Yeah, there was right. the nationwide network of 56 mosques right. where they would just. And of course, they had Muslim names, so it was a good cover. And so for law enforcement, which was predominantly white, didn't understand Islam, didn't understand names or whatever, this was a major mess. Never mind the idea that there are actually Black organized criminals who are moving this kind of money and whatever. So anyway, with regard to Muhammad Ali, he, of course, was a Nation of Islam member. One of the people who converted him to the nation was a guy named Jeremiah Shabazz. Jeremiah Shabazz, at the time when he converted Muhammad, was down in Atlanta. He was in the South. But by the time we get to Philly's Black Mafia history, Jeremiah Shabazz is running the Nation of Islam's Temple 12, which is Philly. For those of you who don't know, back then, the nation, every city had numbered mosques. Philly was number 12. And Jeremiah Shabazz was its leader. He was also one of the most influential people nationwide in the movement. He was, I don't know how you would rank people close to Elijah Muhammad, but he was up there. Anyway, So he and Muhammad Ali and Jeremiah Shabazz were very close friends. It was one of his mentors. And when Muhammad Ali gets kicked out of boxing for rejecting the draft, he spends his years in exile in Philly. And that's how he becomes such
Cherry Hill.
Right. For those of you who don't know, Cherry Hill, New Jersey is a beautiful, well, at least back then, I don't know what it's like now, was a beautiful suburb. And yeah, I say suburb of Philly, even though it's in another state. It's right over the bridge over the Delaware River. And a lot of prominent Philadelphians, whether it was celebrities or people of wealth, would live in Cherry Hill, take the trip across the bridge and do their work and things like that in Philly. Well, that was Muhammad Ali. And the person who got him to move to Cherry Hill, New Jersey, was a major person in Philadelphia Black Mafia history named Major Coxon. He, of course, was a flim-flam guy, not into violence at all. He was just a hustler. People may know that he ran for mayor of Camden, New Jersey in 1972. He lost to Angelo Arricchetti. There's a great anecdote with that. I don't know if I told you last time I was with you, Scott, but the great story is one of the reporters who was offended that Major Coxon, this career criminal, was running for mayor, said, "Don't you have some nerve running for mayor office with your background? You serve time in federal prison." And Coxon said, "In New Jersey, typically people become politicians and then go to prison. I'm reversing the trend." And what's great about that was Angelo Arricchetti was one of the people who got arrested in Abscam.
In Abscam. And then he was a character played by Jeremy Renner in the Hustle, movie, right? American Hustle. American they just Hustle. Changed the name to Carmine Polito, that they changed.
Okay. Okay. Well, anyway, so you've got all this stuff happening at the same time. You've got a prominent figure in Muhammad Ali. You've got Major Coxon. Now, I have to tell people, if you read Black Brothers, you see some of the images, but I have, I don't know, hundreds of news headlines about all this. And it's not the organized crime stuff that you might think, because we're looking at this backward in history and we know what murderous people these were and what wind up happening to them. But if you're looking at headlines all throughout the 60s and early 70s, these people are glamorized. Major Coxon is getting headline coverage on newspapers in New Jersey. We're talking about Beau Bains. Philadelphia Magazine in 1975, this is just after the indictment. He was put in their January issue. They had 75 people to watch in 1975. Beau Bains was one of them.
Yep.
They were legendary figures in the Philadelphia community.
Beyond the Underworld.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Major Coxon was a mainstay at City Hall. He was also a mainstay with the nation, with the NAACP. So if you're a Black community resident and you're being extorted and having your places firebombed or whatever, you can't process all of this because you see these people doing what they're doing to your community, but you also see them on TV, you see them in the newspaper, and they're being glamorized as civil rights leaders and community action agency leaders. Because that's one thing I left out in my attempt at doing this briefly. That was back in the age of community action agencies, where the federal government was giving money purposely. This is what people get wrong, and I was one of them back in the 90s when I started this. They were targeting criminals. The argument was that poverty was causing crime. So if you gave people money, they wouldn't have the need to commit crime.
There'd be no reason to do crime anymore.
So when I got the incorporation documents, I'm thinking that people like Beau Bains or James Fox or whomever, they're not going to list their actual names in these applications. I'm thinking they're going to say Sean Griffin, Scott Bernstein. No, right. They're actually listing their names because that was how you got the money. And so they had community storefronts, community action agencies. It was unreal what they were doing. And by the way, we focus on the murders. I love the white collar crime aspect of this because one of the scams they committed from the community action agencies was they started getting credit cards because they could actually document income. Well, they wound up using, and they made up fake names, of course, got credit cards, and they used them to rent cars, and they became a part of a major car theft ring. There are dozens of examples of that. These are like fascinating criminals.
Last thing I want to talk about before we go into the 74 bust, and it's just closing up this last 10 minutes. So Major Coxon gets killed. Gets involved in a drug ripoff between the Italian mafia in New York and the Philly mobs.
It was the Gambino crime family in New York, right. And they were sending $1 million shipment to who? Beau Bains, your guy.
Which got intercepted.
Yeah.
Coxon agrees to get the money back, but actually ends up in debt for that money because he had made promises
His deal was he told the Gambinos, I'll get the stuff back, and he was going to get paid $300,000. He subcontracted $200,000 to Philly's Black Mafia and said, okay, we either need the stuff or the people. Well, who knows? It's the underworld. Who the heck knows? Right. But either way, the two drug dealers who stole the drugs
wind up dead
in Camden. Yeah. So now the Gambinos are furious. They're not going to get their drugs back or the money. And now the feds are all over the murders. So they stiff Coxon for the money. And Coxon is, the clock's ticking on his life because Sam Christian and the boys are not too cool about getting stiffed on the $200,000.
They're like, you promised us this money if we did this, and we don't care if you're friends with us, and we don't care if you live next door to Muhammad Ali, which he did. Ali bought or purchased or built a mansion right next to Major Coxon. Coxon's killed. At this point, Ali obviously starts to back away a little bit from these people. Yeah. But how much, Ali kind of comes into their orbit in 68, 69. I don't know. He beat Liston in 63 or 64. And then right after that, he converted. So but I guess my question is, it doesn't really matter what the timeline is. How, in your educated opinion, how much did Muhammad Ali know about? I know he knows that he was surrounding himself with Nation people. He knew that all the Nation people weren't saints. I get that. But how much did he realize the people that he was socializing with were straight killers that would kill you as quick as they would go get a sandwich at the, in the middle of a football game?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, as you might imagine. People close to him say that they knew, like they were fully aware. And by the way, according to them, they warned him to get away from this world. They knew everything that was going on. The thing is, look, like you just made a good point. Like, even if you didn't know the details, but the point, by the time you get to that era where they're killing, people like crazy, and making a big deal out of it. Never mind the setting people on fire. They did a lot of noteworthy things other than just shooting people.
Yeah.
And they'd beheaded one person, of course. They were legendary for how they did it. Well, the point being, when they would go into bars or they'd go into wherever you were with them, everybody knew, don't mess with that crowd at the end of the table. You know what I mean? And so it wasn't simply that they're a Nation of Islam members or that they are Philly Black Mafia. He and his crowd knew whether they knew the details of the murders, who the heck knows, but he knew he was running with a really rough crowd.
And then it went from somebody that was very proud to, at least with Major Coxon, he was very proud of his association. He was shouting him out in the ring. He'd grab a mic from Howard Cosell, start shouting Major Coxon out on the, and then after Major Coxon is murdered, Muhammad Ali, when he's asked about it, was like, I barely knew the guy.
Yeah, he also said that Major Coxon was not a Muslim, so I couldn't be friends with him. Okay, and yet, by the way, before then, he had called Major Coxon not only a close friend, but it was his financial advisor.
Yeah.
And like you said, that's literally why he moved. That's why he moves the doors away from him or whatever. Incidentally, you can find all this stuff on YouTube. These interviews are all over the place where he's talking about Major Coxon back in 1972.
So let's go to September of 74, and then I want to just lay something out for you and then just let you loose. So I learned from researching this the last couple of days. I learned about how this bus came together, and I want to kind of get your take on it. Bo Baines was the number one defendant in this case, but number two defendant was James Fox, who I'm told by some people called him Fifth Street Jimmy. He was a guy that was a former, but used to be a part of some like youth groups that had nothing to do with crime.
Yes.
And then he was put in charge. Once Philly Black Mafia got stood up, he was put in charge of basically like consolidating heroin dealers in North Philly, lining them up to get behind the Black Mafia family. And then going into these youth centers that he used to be a part of and like transforming them into like feeder groups for Philly Black Mob and all that stuff. So he has a common law brother-in-law named Mickey Robinson, who isn't jammed up, unprompted, walks into the DEA office in March of 1974 and says, you know, I'm a tool, I'm an instrument, use me to take down my brother-in-law and his group. And for the next 6 months, he's wiring up and making phone calls and making drug buys. And can you just talk about how this all went down?
I'm glad you referenced Charles Mickey Robinson, because if you study the decades of Philly's Black Mafia history, he's the only informant. People would not talk about Philly's Black Mafia. It's one of the biggest challenges. I actually write a lot about that in the book. I interviewed so many people in federal law enforcement in Philly, or DAs. They just couldn't get people to cooperate. And by the way, some of the DAs actually didn't want people to cooperate because they knew they couldn't protect them. That's how rough it was back then.
And Robinson, Robinson was like best friends at one point, was best friends with James Fox.
Yeah.
And felt, from reading what I read, felt personally offended to some degree that Fox was going back into these old youth centers and corrupting these 10, 11, 12-year-olds.
Yeah. There's also a quote in the book where Charles Mickey Robinson said that one of the things that really offended him was, quote unquote, they were misusing Islam. And what had happened, he left Philly and he, like you say, he leaves James Fox and all these people in legitimate efforts to, you know, take care of gang warfare and get kids out of harm's way and things like that, comes back to find them manipulated, just like you say, as feeder groups or whatever. That's why, by the way, for people who don't know, the reason the book is called Black Brothers Incorporated is because that's their most infamous community action agency, which was run by James Fox and Gene Hearn. And anyway, so James Fox, by the way, was called by Councilman Foglietti. He called him the next Martin Luther King Jr. They honestly believe that this crowd of people led by James Fox were going to be the solution to urban warfare and problems with teenage gang violence. And so when Mickey Robinson comes back, he can't believe what he sees. And like you say, he goes and volunteers himself and they wire him up. And that, but importantly, and I'm sure your audience knows this, but people don't, this matters because what happens next couldn't have happened a few years earlier. For people who don't know the history of this, we only get wiretapping in 1968, and then the Organized Crime Control Act is 1970, and that's where you get all the witness protection stuff. And so the tools that are going to be used against Philly's Black Mafia in late 73 and 74, you couldn't have done it a few years earlier. I always say if Philly's Black Mafia had started a decade earlier, this would have gone on another decade. They were hitting their stride at the wrong time because federal authorities were figuring out how to use all these new tools.
It did. The one thing that I noticed, and I want to get your insight on, it seemed like the guy, and it wasn't when Robinson started cooperating and wearing wires and doing deals, he wasn't just dealing with James Fox. He was dealing with a lot of these other dangerous, notorious figures in James Fox orbit. The one that I know comes to mind, I saw some wires, and it was Herschel Williams, what they called the Jolly Green Giant, who was like, you know, very imposing and loved the job as an enforcer. He'd eventually die by the sword as well. But it looked like Mickey Robinson didn't have to do a lot of creating. It looked like they were okay dealing drugs with him, which makes me believe he wasn't necessarily a fully, not just a straight arrow, regular civilian. And maybe I'm wrong, unless they just said, oh, well, now he wants to work with us, so we'll start giving him drugs. But it seemed very like seamless, like he was immediately negotiating drug deals with these guys at a level that they would only be dealing with people that they knew in that world.
Well, the thing is, back then, gangs were a really big deal. But when I say gangs in the 60s are different than now, where people were in gangs just for territory. They weren't necessarily dealing drugs or murdering people or anything like that or whatever. I think Charles Robinson was familiar in that realm where he was street savvy and could get by or whatever. And so I think he could talk the talk and be in that world without blinking an eye. And so when he came back and it had flipped, I don't really know the answer to that question, but I can imagine him being savvy enough to be able to you know, seamlessly go through all that sort of stuff.
I found that interesting when I was going through stuff that I was like, it didn't take him a lot of time to get to the point where he was asking these guys like, hey, feed me and feed me more than just for my personal use.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, all of these major players are kind of engaging with him. It just made me, and I wanted to point this out to the audience, because it sounds like a guy that just shows up at the DEA headquarters with no case hanging over him, and it's not like he's being jammed to cooperate. So I guess my initial impression was, oh, this guy was kind of a square and just didn't like what was going on, but maybe there's a middle ground there.
Well, the other thing, too, is don't forget that the infamous 20th and Carpenter Street gang was always going at it with Philly's Black Mafia.
Right.
And that plays a role, too. So I just think he was in that world. And I don't think it shocked anyone that he would be hanging out with them. And I don't forget, he hasn't been around. So they have nothing to fear. They know him from 3 or 4 years earlier. So they incorporate him back into the scene, even though the scene is different now.
And they went to trial pretty quickly. It looked like the trial was in 75.
Yeah. March of 75.
And
well, technically speaking, there were three trials. The big one was March of 75.
Herschel Williams is killed in 75 by his brother-in-law, or in a dispute with his brother-in-law and some other guys. So I think that was when he was out on bond before he hit trial. But most of these guys are convicted. And if you read Black Brothers Inc., Sean does such a great job of like really. The building a narrative that is like a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you had a succession of guys throughout the rest of the decade that tried to keep things moving forward, but it seemed like every time somebody would pop up and try to take things over, he'd be killed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then there were just different iterations to the point where it just kind of, they ceased to exist by the early 80s. And then by the mid to late 80s, JBM came up, but that really wasn't the same anywhere really. JBM was a drug gang.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Different than what.
Right. Well, that's what you just said is exactly right. When, by the time you get to the late 70s, but here's the thing, I'm sure you know this from all the other guests you've had on. Even for Italian gangsters in Philly, once the feds figured out how to do this, that's when you started seeing more internecine warfare, because now there's a real fear of informants, because it's so easy between the witness protection program and being able to wire people. Leaning on people for decades and decades was not a problem because no one's recording anything. You didn't have to worry about that. And they were correctly fearful for their lives. Well, now there was an entire mechanism to deal with that. So that's why you see, like, with the Italian guys, once Bruno is killed, it's chaos ever since in 1980.
Ever since.
Yeah. I mean, so that's what I'm saying. So Philly's Black Mafia, going back to what I said earlier, had they not made the mistake of trying to commandeer drug territories, you know, who knows what would have happened, but that's what they did. And we're like Black Brothers, I believe there were 7 people at the opening of Black Brothers as executives. 5 are in the picture that I put in the book, and there are 2 off screen. 5 of them wind up being killed from other people in the picture.
Right.
Like they all start killing each other over the, I mean, just that's that world once you're in the drug world.
So as we're going to wrap up, we got about 5, 6, 7 more minutes. I want to touch on another person in the bus that we haven't talked about yet. And then I want to draw a line to the JBM and just ask you a question about today. So Russell Barnes was one of the people in the 74 bust. It looks like he was, according to the indictment, he was in charge of the Little Brothers, which were like the gophers and the teenage errand boys. He was in charge of kind of recruiting. It looks like a lot of guys that he, let's say, mentored at that time period, as well as guys that Nudie Mims mentored, eventually become Junior Black Mafia. But Russell Barnes ends up dead. He's killed in 1986. Can you just, in maybe 2 minutes, give us, well, how did that happen?
Sure. Well, for people who don't know the story, Russell Barnes was not simply a feeder person. He was not mentoring. He was not just mentoring. He was a contract killer. He was a very small person. It's weird. Philly's Black Mafia had big guys. Sam Christian, Nudie Mimsy are tall.
They look like linebackers. They look like linebackers in that.
Yeah. And this is an era where people aren't lifting weights. They were just naturally big guys. Right. And yet Russell Barnes is this short guy. I don't know, 5'7", maybe. I mean, short compared to the rest of everyone else. Well, anyway, he was known for violence. And by the time he got killed, it was all, again, it was drug territories, whatever. But with regard to the gangs that he was nurturing, poor choice of words, what they were doing, though, it wasn't just getting them used as drug couriers or whatever. They would go around to all the storefronts and they would tell them that you had to get a sticker. And the sticker was this property protected by Black Brothers Incorporated. And plenty of people would say, oh, no, thank you. We're fine. This is a perfectly safe neighborhood. And they would say, no, you don't understand. This is a really bad neighborhood. And of course, if they didn't pay the street tax, they'd get firebombed or someone would get hurt or whatever. That was what happened. But again, if you're a Black resident and you're seeing posters all over telephone poles and billboards and in the newspaper, you know, we're protecting from gang warfare. You know,
it was viral marketing before the term viral.
Well, I always joke they may actually have lessened gang warfare only because everyone was petrified of them. But anyway, so that's what Russell Barnes' main job was. And he was killed over a lucrative drug territory.
Last two questions. First is a question about yesteryear. And then the last question I'll ask is about kind of today. Sam Christian, I read in some of these files I had the other day, it looked like he comes out of prison and attempts to muscle into the Junior Black Mafia, but like kind of does it on the sly, where he's like, I can be somebody that makes sure that everybody gets along, but wink, wink, I want all your business.
Yeah, that's what
but it didn't work, right?
No, right. Exactly. Yeah, he wants the benefits without any of the costs. That's what he wanted.
How did Aaron Jones and those guys keep him at bay?
I think by that point I don't think he had anywhere near the street reputation. And look, in his earlier years, street reputation would have been irrelevant. He just would have taken action, but that was over. I don't know. I know in his later years, he was nowhere near as aggressive because his camp reached out to me multiple times to write a book about him. Okay. And that was one of their arguments to me, which is, look, that life is over. You know, he wants to make amends. So
when did Sam Christian die?
Oh, geez.
Was it in the last decade or was it back in the? Because Bo Baines died in 12. Bo Baines died in 12. 2012.
Yeah. I think it's since then. I think it's since I've been at the Citadel now for 10 years. I think it's since I got here. I wound up writing an article for Philadelphia Magazine summarizing Sam Christian's significance in Philadelphia history. And I'm pretty sure I did that down here, but I don't really know offhand.
All right. So last question as we wrap up, even though Philadelphia Black Mafia is long gone, there are still JBM guys, Junior Black Mafia guys, that are active. I don't know if it's an organization per se. The original group, Philly Black Mafia, as well as the Junior Black Mafia, did a lot of business with the Italians. They seem to be, in some case, I don't want to speak for Sam and Ron because they didn't seem to be enamored by anybody, but certain people in those groups seem to be enamored by the Italians. Right now, Joey Merlino, who is, you know, has been the face of the Philadelphia Mafia for 30 years. If you do, you know, you just do a regular Google image search, you find a lot of photos, and some of them in the last couple of years with a number of JBM guys. The names that I, you know, Benny Goff, Tracy Mason, and those guys. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, that's news to me. I'm not shocked, but that's interesting. I didn't know that. I just know that, my focus obviously was on Philly's Black Mafia, where people like Lonnie Dawson were dealing with Long John Martirano for years.
Right. Right.
And you know, they were dealing this stuff for years together in and out of prison. And so when the JBM guys came along and they were doing what we talked about this last time I was on the pod, I mean, they were, again, these were like friendly. They'd hang out, socialize together and all that sort of stuff. And then when Ram Squad came along, you saw the same thing, which was short for Richard Allen Mafia, which was one of the big drug territories in Philly with a lot of Black Mafia lineage. Because there's all the Italians, I don't know about Joey Merlino in particular, but they love the hip-hop scene. They love the flash. They love all the attention that all these guys were getting. And not to mention, they could obviously do deals together. So I don't know if they're still active today. I do you know? Is your sense that they're still active on the street?
Do I know if who? We're talking about JBM?
Joey Merlino and those guys. Yeah, with are they still?
The Philadelphia Mafia is still very active. There was actually just a report this week.
I'm saying with the JBM guys.
Yes, the Philadelphia Mafia is still doing business with the JBM. I've reported that. I know that Tracy Mason, particularly, has been around Joey Merlino in the last couple of months. Merlino is. This is a very tenuous subject for me because Joey Merlino has kind of taken a lot of my reporting personally and has really been coming after me quite vociferously. So I don't want to go too much into it, but Joey has some issues with other Italian mob guys, so he has to kind of be careful where he's traveling and where he's going. And I've been told Tracy Mason is kind of running part of his security right now when he comes into Philadelphia. And, you know, Tracy Mason is OG JBM.
That would make sense. I like that. All right.
Thank you so much. And this was great. I think we did a good job of covering everything we needed to cover. You're always welcome back. I love talking to, you know, fellow authors and historians and people that nerd out on this stuff like I do. So this was great. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Please, everyone check out Black Brothers, Inc. If you haven't read it, you need to read it. I'm not just saying this because Sean's here. I fell in love with this book a good 10, 15 years before I ever met Sean. It's truly one of the great true crime books, of this generation of the last 25, 30, 40 years. Please check it out. Sean, tell everyone else where they can get anything that else in terms of stuff.
Well, thank you very much for the nice words. Obviously, the book's available anywhere you would get books. You can also see a ton of analysis on my website, which is seanpatrickgriffin.net or .com. I actually own both now. You can follow me on Twitter at @spgauthor. And Twitter is kind of boring. I should say X, I guess, is boring. But anything that involves my research stuff, I post there. Any news items, if my guys are back in the news, which still happens, I post stuff. But my website has all sorts of analysis that's way beyond the book. Because even though the book was written in 2007, that many of them didn't stop doing things. And so I update the site instead of just writing another edition of the book.
But this was great. Thank you so much, Sean. Enjoy the weekend. I love Charleston. When I get there next time, I promise I'm taking you out for a meal and more than one beer.
Would love to do it.
Thank you, everybody. Keep tuning in to OG Pod. We're uncovering the underworld every day, breaking news all the time. Check OG Pod, check the Gangster Report, our companion web magazine. And then we're doing our Patreon thing now, too, which is a little bit different, more analysis, more, you know, kind of insider nerdy stuff than you get on just the straight YouTube, but you're going to get the interview both on both platforms. So thank you so much, Sean. I'll see you guys next week. I'm Scott Bernstein, OG Pod out.